of the jurisdiction of intersection 263 C, 1012. Tennessee, Boyles against Boyles, 41 Tennessee, 284. This is an old case, 1860, but it's still the law in Tennessee. In this case, the Tennessee Supreme Court specifically held that an individual not a party to the suit and not named in the injunction, either specifically nor as a member of a group, was nonetheless bound by an injunction, even though his acts in violation of the injunction occurred before the injunction was actually issued, if the said stranger had knowledge of the fire before the injunction. Mr. Haynes Jr. all mentioned the report of the Committee on the Operation of the Jury System on Free Press Bad Trial Issue and board addressed to the Chief Justice of the United States and members of the Judicial Conference of the United States. This committee was led by Chairman Irving R. Kaufman, and the report is dated September 1968. The court has read this report with great interest, and on page 16 of said report it is stated. The Supreme Court of the United States has indicated in Shepard against Maxwell that the courts have both the power and responsibility to ensure that a fair trial by an impartial jury is afforded every criminal defendant. However, the power of the courts to control the news media and other sources of possible prejudice to a defendant is, under the Constitution, not without limits. See Woods against Georgia, 370. U.S. 375, 1962. What is Redwood against Georgia, the facts of which are not here apposite. In this case, however, the criteria of the great landmark cases in free speech, free press curtailment are reviewed. Cases of Bridges against California, 314 U.S. 252. Pennekamp against Florida, 328 U.S. 331. Craig against Hunt, 331 U.S. 367. Laid down the guidelines that the exercise of judicial power over out-of-court publications were to be governed by the clear and present danger standard. That order working principle that the substantive evil must be extremely serious and the degree of imminence extremely high before utterance can be punished, as in Bridges at page 263. And quote, the fires which the expression kindles must constitute an imminent, not merely a likely threat to the administration of justice. The danger must not be remote or even probable. It must be immediately in peril. That's in Harney at page 376. This court is of the considered opinion that the extrajudicial statements herein complained of are extremely prejudicial and constitute a clear and present danger to the selection of an impartial jury and the holding of a fair trial for both defendant and the state. Such prejudicial extrajudicial statements are extremely serious, and the degree of imminence of peril is extremely high. And the prejudice which such statements constitute an imminent, not merely likely threat to the administration of justice. The danger of prejudicing prospective jurors is not remote, nor even probable, but is immediately imperative. The court is dissuaded that all the criteria above set out are met by the facts and circumstances of this case. The court takes notes these significant words of the Supreme Court of the United States in Shepard against Maxwell, 384 U.S. 333 at page 362, and I quote, had the judge and the other officers of the court and the police placed the interest of justice first, the news media would have soon learned to be content with the task of reporting the case as it unfolded in the courtroom, not pieced together from extrajudicial statements. This court must place the interest of justice first. Justice demands a fair trial by an impartial jury for both the defendant, James Earl Ray, and the state of Tennessee. It is my present opinion that the respondents, each fail to show good cause why they should not be held in contempt for the violating the orders of this court, which they had notice. I am not yet ready to decide what final disposition should be made of the matter. It might well be that future action and conduct of all or some of these respondents might be considered as a mitigation or even as a purgation of the offense. Consequently, I reserve final disposition of this matter for a future day.
Unfortunately, in this basic conflict, we
problem that arises now is to have a matter in which a court has expressed such careful study of the First Amendment's concepts to then find that there is a situation in which two reporters reporting something which has been given to them by people who are directly under the order of the court are in violation of that order of the court. This, if you look at it, sir, could be one of the great circumventions of the First Amendment of all time. And I don't believe that the newspapers in this country or the other media can possibly permit this concept. As you may very well realize, there have been justice of the peace courts who have undertaken to put prohibitions on what can be published in newspapers. Now, the fact is that in the Shepherd case, as you so ably pointed out, the court pointed the finger at the court's processes and the requirements of what the court should do to preserve the rights under the Sixth Amendment to fair trial. On the other hand, the court did not move in on the First Amendment rights of the people to talk, free speech, and of the publishers to publish. The fact is that if these reporters are in violation of this order, then every individual in this entire group who read of the court's order and who since that time has discussed the things stated in these stories equally are in contempt of this court's order. Now, this is the breadth of the impact of this sort of thing and the very reason that in English law they developed some kind of a concept of free speech, some kind of a concept that courts could not clamp a tight lid on what was going on. Yet in our country, if there's been one outstanding major contribution to progress, if we consider this sort of thing progress, which I do, made in our Constitution that is far ahead of the British law, and I think it is self-evident, Your Honor, that if it becomes possible to inhibit the reporting of news of